So not quantum gravity per se, but the pursuit of mathematical methods that hopefully somebody may pick up and find useful. When we look at the problem of quantum gravity, we notice that part of the difficulty of it is probably that the two theories that you want to unify are expressed in two very different mathematical languages. There's general relativity, whose mathematical language is differential geometry, all about metrics, curvature, and so on, parallel transport, affine connections. And then there's quantum theory, whose mathematical language is that of functional analysis, operator, spectra, entanglement, unitary evolution, stuff like that. Mathematically very different from what is going on here. Now, the fundamental theory of quantum gravity, whatever it ultimately turns out to be, will not only have to unify quantum theory and gravity, implicitly, it must also unify those two mathematical disciplines. Somehow they must merge, naturally work together in order to make quantum gravity work. So let us ask, is there a mathematical discipline which is concerned with bringing together differential geometry and functional analysis? Maybe we can pull something useful from that. And there is indeed such a discipline, and that is the discipline called spectral geometry. Spectral geometry is older than quantum theory even. It goes back to the 19-teens, founded by Hermann Weyl. And spectral geometry is concerned with a bunch of questions. The one that I'm concerned with today is the question, how far the shape of an object is determined by its sound. See, on one hand, we have an object such as a vase, no water, no flowers, sorry, just the empty vase. And the information about the vase is its shape, its curvature. It's a two-dimensional object. It would be described differential geometrically, differential manifold, metric on it. The fact that it's embedded is not that important, that it's embedded in 3D. On the other hand, when we take a spoon to it and make it ring, then it will create an acoustic spectrum, something like that spectrum here. It's a bit noisy, but that has to do with the amplifier, and the lines are not entirely sharp because there's dissipation that will widen the line width and so on. But in principle, there's a sharp, distinct spectrum. This, and technically, well, acoustically we call it the spectrum, but technically it really is the spectrum of a self-adjoint operator, namely the Laplace operator on that manifold. Here's the wave equation. The spectrum is really just the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. So spectral geometry asks, to what extent can we obtain the shape of the vase from knowing just the sound of it? If we can do that, if we can go back and forth between the two, that would be fantastic. I mean, one direction is guaranteed. If we know the shape, we can calculate the sound, just solve that differential equation. But in order to actually have a proper bridge between the two things, the shape and the acoustics, we need to go back. And there are some results of spectral geometry which are positive, and they say that if we have that the object is a surface of revolution, for example, then you can make positive statements about being able to deduce the shape from the sound. You see, this is differential geometry, that's functional analysis here, and spectral geometry might just provide a nice bridge, a two-way bridge, so that we could describe whatever goes on geometrically, ultimately also completely functional analytically, and vice versa. We might take regular stuff in quantum mechanics, regular things that are not geometric in nature, and start describing them geometrically if we want to. That would be the power of this if it works. So the prospect is that if this can be made to work in physics, spectral geometry, then we would replace the vase by the universe, and we would replace, or the space-time more precisely, and we would replace the spectrum with what this lady is doing here at U of T. She has a homodyne detector, and she's measuring quantum vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. See, space-time would be like the vase. It has curvature. And described by a metric. If we took a spoon to the vase, we make it ring. What's the spoon for the universe? You don't need a spoon because of quantum fluctuations, it should be ringing all the time. Not very much. It's not making particularly loud noise. But in principle, because of quantum fluctuations of space-time and of the fields that live on it, there should always be some sort of background noise which has a spectrum. And then the question is, from that spectrum, which in principle is accessible by measuring quantum vacuum fluctuations, which we can do, in principle, this could be a telescope. Right? In principle, if you can tell from the spectrum of the noise what the shape is, right, then you can describe this in terms of that. So the question is whether spectral geometry could be used to describe space-time curvature in terms of a spectrum or in terms of spectra. Now, in what I will talk in the rest talk about in the rest of this talk will be mostly concerned with the Riemannian manifold case. So just think of space alone or the Wick rotated four-dimensional space-time. So that would be quite nice if we could express general relativity in quantum mechanical terms, because that mathematical bridge might turn out to be useful for quantum gravity. You see, it wouldn't mean that we quantize gravity. It just means that we can express it in a quantum mechanical language in terms of spectra. And then it might be more ready to quantize. Of course, it wouldn't be a practical method. I'm not saying that in a lab you would have suddenly a great telescope. Still much easier to measure with a telescope, with an actual telescope, the Einstein rings, and from that deduce the curvature, than trying to use the measurement of quantum fluctuation somewhere in a lab on Earth to measure what the curvature billions of light years away might be. But as a matter of principle, it could stand. There's a big problem, though, which deflates that dream. It turns out that spectral geometry has counterexamples. None that I know of in two dimensions, for the case of detecting curvature from sound, but certainly there are high-dimensional manifolds that are not isometric, but definitely isospectral. This goes back to work by Milner, Gordon, and in particular Sunada, who even cooked up a method to produce such isospectral non-isometric manifolds. So it would seem that, nope, generally we just can't go back. We can't go from the spectrum to the shape. The spectrum doesn't encode all of the information about the curvature. And we have to ask ourselves, why should it work in the first place? It was just a guess by Weil that this might go far, but maybe it doesn't go all that far, because there are counterexamples. So it seems that it's just a beautiful dream, cannot work. We seem to be back to square one. But certainly, the question remains, how can we unify differential geometry in functional analysis? They need to somehow play together nicely in that final theory of quantum gravity. So let's give it another shot. Let's restart with this observation. Quantum fields, in this case, a quantum field which is a Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space, ultimately consists of harmonic oscillators. So that's the Klein-Gordon equation. Let's drop that term for a moment. If we drop that term, then we see that we have, at every point in space, psi is a function of x and t. So if you hold x fixed and drop that term, then for every x, you have a harmonic oscillator here. Right? Simply a harmonic oscillator, with this being here the spring constant. So at every point in space, we have a harmonic oscillator. I mean, to most of you, of course, this is totally known. But just to make sure we are all on the same page, I'm going through this. Now, we do have that term with spatial derivatives as well. Think of it as at the moment as discretized space. Then this Laplacian becomes a finite difference operator. And there we see what happens. those harmonic oscillators get coupled to each other because of those spatial derivatives. So what space-time consists of in quantum field theory is a bunch of harmonic oscillators. At every point in space, there is one. And those harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. And that means that the joint ground state of all those harmonic oscillators, the vacuum state, so the ground state of this combined system, is not the tensor product of the ground states of those individual harmonic oscillators, because they are coupled to each other. And it turns out that the ground state, the vacuum state, is therefore an entangled state, spatially entangled. If you take some harmonic oscillators over here, some harmonic oscillators over there, trace over the rest, you find that the system is in an entangled state. The two pieces are entangled. Which means that the quantum fluctuations, the quantum vacuum fluctuations of a quantum field, are spatially quantum correlated, more than classically correlated. There's entanglement in there, which, by the way, you can swap and extract. OK, so how does that help us? Well, consider now space-time with curvature. Now the Klein-Gordon equation looks like this, where the D'Alembert operator now shows that it depends very strongly on the metric and therefore on the curvature. Therefore, this, and actually the argument that I gave earlier still goes through. At every point in space, you have a harmonic oscillator. But the coupling between those harmonic oscillators is now very much non-trivial and determined by the metric, therefore by the shape of the space-time. So it's still true that the vacuum state, whatever the vacuum state happens to be in curved space-time, is certainly affected by the curvature. The entanglement present in the vacuum state will be affected by the fact that space, that space-time is curved. Now, here comes the big step, the big question. While it is clear that curvature impacts the entanglement of the vacuum, it's a non-trivial question whether just knowing the entanglement structure of the vacuum, you can reconstruct what the curvature of space-time is. If we could do that, we could describe what is usually done by using metrics and so on, the curvature of space-time, simply without those tools, instead by describing how things are entangled in the quantum field theory. We would build a mathematical bridge between the differential geometry of GR and the functional analysis of quantum theory. But is it true? Curvature affects the entanglement of the vacuum. But does the entanglement of the vacuum know all about the curvature? Does it encode all about the curvature? Can we extract it?
So what do you think all coupling functions?
Getting to that. You're a little ahead of time. So see, there it is. OK. So the big question is, can the curvature be recovered from the properties of the vacuum field fluctuation? Let us look at those fluctuations. Here's a two-point function. And so it's a correlator. It measures how correlated the fluctuations at a point x2 are to the fluctuations at a point x1. If they're uncorrelated, then the average value of their product is 0. If they're correlated, it's positive. It's the larger, the more they're correlated. Now, so the question is, this encodes quantum fluctuations. And it will encode also the impact of curvature on the quantum fluctuations. Let us ask whether, from the knowledge of such two-point functions, we can reconstruct what the curvature was or is. Why would that, how could that possibly work? Well, we start with the observation that the two-point function actually drops with distance. The further two points are away from each other, the less they will be correlated. It's not a simple relationship on a generic curved space-time, but it's a general relationship. Now, distances, we know, encode the shape of space. So maybe because this is something that's very intrinsically distance dependent, maybe this will tell us enough about distances so that we can recover what the shape of the space-time is. Let's see. Ultimately, the idea goes back to Einstein, who credits Helmholtz, and it's really going back to Gauss. It's a very simple idea, namely that curvature is encoded in the distances. Gauss already asked, if I have a lot of triangles and I measure distances, then in a flat space, there ought to be a lot of non-trivial relationships between those distances. If they are not fulfilled, I can deduce that really I'm living in a curved space. He even tried to measure it with a null result, but then curvature was too small for him to measure. So we start with this observation that, and Einstein makes that point quite explicitly in one of his publications. He says that, well, I'm using affine connections and I'm using the metric, but really, there's nothing fundamental to that. And he makes the point that the shape of a space-time can also be encoded in other ways, among them, just in knowing distances. So let's use that fact and combine that with the fact that the distance between two points on the manifold can be determined, or is at least very much related to the strength of the quantum correlations, to the strength of the correlation between quantum fluctuations at the two points. It's not a linear relationship between the correlator and the distance, but it's a monotonic relationship. But even that is probably not so important that it's monotonic. So before we do the quantum version of this, let's do the classical version. Curvature in terms of length. Imagine a museum, and there's a dinosaur in that museum. They even went through the trouble of not just putting together the bones, no, they reconstructed the skin to give you the shape and the color and everything. So now your task as a student job was to measure that dinosaur. What do? You sprinkle points on the dinosaur fairly evenly, but of course not continually, just discrete points you sprinkle there. And then let's say you measure the mutual distance between any pair of those points and record that in a matrix. You get a huge n by n matrix. If you use n points, you get an n by n matrix of mutual distances between any pair of points. That matrix is, of course, a symmetric matrix, because the distance from point I to point j is the same as vice versa. Then, as fate has it, the museum burns down. But you have that matrix, that n by n matrix, on your Dropbox. So you can recover that. And then the museum approaches you and says, can you reconstruct the dinosaur? I understand you can't reconstruct it better than this average spacing between the points that you sprinkled there, but maybe at least as far as that. And there you are. You have your matrix. And you just have distances. You have nothing else. There's no label on the points. It's just endpoints and their distances. Now, in principle, you can actually reconstruct that dinosaur, if you think about it. It's extremely highly over-constrained. Can't even move one point. Can't make an elephant that has that table of distances. So you've encoded your dinosaur in this matrix of n squared entries. But that's a very classical thing to do. What's the quantum version of this? Well, the correlations of quantum noise decay with distance. So what we can do is we can make use of the fact that the vacuum entanglement, which generates those quantum correlations, gives us a measure of distance. So let's say that instead of measuring the actual distances between any two points that we sprinkled there, we measure the value of the two-point correlator. So then we end up with a n by n matrix of two-point correlators. Hilary. Can't. You cannot distinguish them. Correct. Good point. Later on, when we do the quantum version, I will mention that you would need handed particles, like neutrinos or so, to be able to tell something left-handed from something right-handed. Yes, that's right. The mirror dinosaur would have the same distance matrix. OK, so the thing is, we've now changed to a quantum description. we now have a matrix of two-point correlators. And same argument, with this, with one matrix, with the matrix for the dinosaur, you can't build an elephant that will have that same matrix. It's just so highly overconstrained. This is just saying what displaying what I already said, namely that the matrix of two-point correlators, these are the vacuum expectation value. This is the vacuum expectation value of the field at a point xn and the point xm, two of the points that we sprinkled onto the dinosaur. And here's our n by n matrix of two-point correlators. So we expect that this matrix actually captures the shape of this dinosaur down to the scale of the sprinkling density. Of course, we can't recover fine details that we simply never measured. So that's nice, because this already allows us to encode curvature in terms of entanglement, ultimately. We could put it on a quantum computer. So for example, in curved space, we would have n points on curved space, n points on a dinosaur. They are mutually entangled. They have certain two-point correlators, etc. And then on a quantum computer, we would have n qubits. Maybe we can do it with qubits. Maybe we need higher. And then we arrange them to be entangled in the same way. Then the dynamics of your space would map into a dynamics of how this entanglement between those endpoints behaves. In any case, it's a description. I'm not saying it's a good description, but it's a description of the curvature that's going on up to a certain scale for a given sprinkling in terms of quantum theoretic expressions. Again, we're not quantizing curvature just yet. We're just describing it in a quantum language to be prepared for quantization later. The trouble with this is the trouble with the stage that we are at the moment is that there's a lot of redundancy in this description. Yes, we described the dinosaur in terms of a matrix, which ultimately could be represented as a bunch of qubits or qudits, which have a certain entanglement to each other. But the whole thing depends very much on how we chose the sprinkling. If we chose a different sprinkling, our matrix would be a very different matrix. And it would still describe the same dinosaur down to the same length scale. So it's an inefficient way of encoding the curvature of the dinosaur in these terms. Because the actual shape degrees of freedom, the actual shape information that is in that matrix, in this n by n matrix, is all mixed up with the choice of the sprinkling point. This probably reminds you of a problem that we normally have with a metric. If we want to quantize gravity and we look at the metric, then we find that, yes, the metric tensor, if you write this 4x4 matrix as a function of space and time, yes, it encodes the shape of your space-time, but inefficiently. Because by just changing coordinates or changing the basis in the tangent spaces, you can make those matrix elements whirl around and become very different matrix elements. And still, you're describing the very same manifold, same shape. And then we face the problem that if you want to quantize, let's say, the metric, then it's a hard thing to separate the actual shape degrees of freedom, which we do want to quantize, from what is just different morphisms and changes of bases and so on, just arbitrary stuff that humans made up. Here, it seems to be similar. We have a matrix, an n by n matrix of two-point correlators. They encode the shape of the manifold that we want to describe, but down to the scale that we want. But it very much depends on the sprinkling. How can we distill the actual shape information out of that matrix? What information in that matrix encodes how the dinosaur looks like down to that scale, independently of how we might have chosen the sprinkling? This is just making the point that it's similar to the metric and its the diffeomorphism dependence of its explicit form. So we want to distill the shape information out of that n by n matrix G of the two-point correlators. Now let us look at what this two-point correlator is. Quantum field theory tells us that it's the equation, it's the Green's function of the Laplacian or the D'Alembertian. I mean, we've Euclideanized, we've Vic-rotated it, so it's the Laplacian. So it's the Green's function to the Laplacian. Okay? So we can write it as matrix elements in the position representation of the inverse of the Laplacian. How is that helpful? Our question was, how can we distill shape information from that matrix G? Well, now we know the matrix G consists, is really just a representation of the inverse of the Laplacian in a certain position basis where we chose certain points. And these are basis vectors in the function space over the manifold. What we now see is that the choice of sprinkling, of which we want to emancipate ourselves, the choice of sprinkling is the choice of basis in the L2 Hilbert space of functions on the manifold. Therefore, if we ask for sprinkling independence, we ought to ask for basis independence. So if we ask what is the shape information that we can distill out of our matrix G, you can say, well, it's got to be information that's basis independent if it's sprinkling independent. But what basis independent information is there in a symmetric matrix like G? It's the spectrum of it. Siavash? No, that's for free field theory, just the propagator equation.
I mean, the two-point function itself, that if you apply box, or in this case, the Laplacian.
You're questioning that? You're questioning this?
Yeah.
You're saying there should be a zero?
Yeah.
No, there are different Green's functions.
Yeah, so that's.
But the Green's function that in the, once you Vic-rotate it, is the two-point function. That would be the Vic-rotation of the Feynman propagator, and the Feynman propagator obeys that.
Oh, I see. So you're talking about the time order.
It's an inhomogeneous solution. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we arrived at the conclusion that the sprinkling independent information ought to be basis independent information, but the basis independent information in a symmetric matrix like G is its spectrum. So, yes.
So what I don't really see is how these two spectra are related to each other. Two submatrices of the big matrix.
Yes, to be precise, I will do that in one of the next slides. I put the cutoff on the spectrum of the Laplacian,
okay,
in which case the Hilbert space becomes finite dimensional. And those basis vectors will all span the same space in this case. And therefore, it's just a regular change of basis in there. They're basically like truncated delta functions where you remove the highest frequencies.
Then there's a very non-trivial constraint.
Yes, exactly. Yes, you're anticipating. This is exactly what will come up. Just a moment. OK. So another try. We are trying to distill the shape information from that matrix. We do that by picking out the spectrum of it, a bunch of real numbers. And the spectrum of G is the spectrum of the Laplacian. It's the inverse of it, right? Because of this. G and the Laplacian are diagonal in the same basis. And so if you know the spectrum of one, you know the spectrum of the other. In other words, we arrived at the conclusion that the information about the shape up to the required scale, now we only take the first n eigenvalues because we only have n points in this. So we arrive at the conclusion that the spectrum of the Laplacian should encode the the sprinkling independent shape information about the dinosaur, and voila, this is apparently what Hermann Weyl was guessing 100 years ago, right? We arrived in a completely new way at the conjecture of spectral geometry, namely that the spectrum of the Laplacian knows everything about the shape of the manifold. But it can't be. There are counterexamples. It can't be. Somewhere we made a mistake in this argument. And Bianca already saw it, I guess. My talking is ahead of my showing. So this is a slide I should have showed you a minute ago. It's just saying that the spectrum of the matrix G contains the same information as the spectrum of the matrix of the Laplace operator, because they're just inverse. The eigenvalues are just inverses to each other. Okay, so what we found is apparently that spacetime can be both continuous and discrete in the same way, as it turns out, as information can be. This is a topic that I don't want to get into because it would take another hour or two to explain that. Let me just briefly say that what we found is that we were able to distill shape information from that matrix, which is sprinkling independent, which means you can choose another sprinkling and recover the same dinosaur information, and then choose yet another sprinkling, and so on. As long as those sprinklings are dense enough, as long as they're always endpoints, you should always be able to reconstruct the same dinosaur. This is mathematically very similar, almost the same, as what is known in engineering as sampling theory, or as in information theory as sampling theory. If you have a band-limited signal, let's say 20 kilohertz bandwidth, as it is the custom in music, then you can record the samples of that signal 40,000 times per second. And it doesn't matter exactly when you take those samples, just on average 40,000 of them per second, twice the band limitation of 20 kilohertz. Then those numbers are stored on a CD, and back home, the CD player can reconstruct the continuous music signal in principle perfectly. No information is lost by the discretization. And remember, it doesn't matter where you discretize, how you discretize. It's just the average density of points that matters. And here we arrived at something very similar. We are sampling, though not just a signal, we are sampling a curved manifold. And again, it doesn't really matter where you choose your points as long as you have enough of them, and you should be able to reconstruct. Of course, there's a dark cloud over all of this, because does spectral geometry really work? But for the moment, let's just say, OK, this is where we are heading here. Oh, and by the way, you may wonder, how can that possibly be true, that it doesn't matter where you choose your points, as long as the density on average is right, or the number of points is sufficient? What if I choose my points only on the nose of the dinosaur? How can I reconstruct the shape of the tail? Mathematically, yes, you can. You can. It's the same in music. You can sample your band-limited music signal very non-equidistantly and still reconstruct. There's just a horrible price to pay, which is that the reconstruction becomes extremely unstable. If you measure your samples not to an extreme precision that grows exponentially with the unevenness of your samples, then the reconstruction errors will go very, very large. But in principle, it really doesn't matter where you put your samples. Anyway, so we find here that a space-time could be described just the way that information can be described as both continuous and discrete. Music is a continuous signal, but everything about it is encoded in just the discrete samples. For a band-limited signal, that's the case, right? The music signal is continuous, but everything about it can be recorded by just recording its amplitudes at a discrete set of points. Similarly here for space-time, it would be continuous space-time in a sense, but everything about it can be encoded, can be recorded by just choosing endpoints down to the scale at which we are working. So the spectrum of the Laplacian seems to define an equivalence class of shapes or of Riemannian structures that differ only below the sprinkling scale. But above that, they are just the same manifold. So you could imagine that with the spectrum, you could describe space-time down to the Planck scale. And then everything below the Planck scale is simply not defined. All those manifolds are in the same equivalence class. Larry? No, no, no. Yeah, I know what you mean, but sampling theory always assumes that you have already all of the signal. This is not something that you can do on the fly.
Right.
Yeah, otherwise you would run into problems, but no. Okay, so what we arrived at is, in a new way, an argument for why spectral geometry should work. The matrix, the n by n matrix of two-point correlators encodes the shape. Then we distill out of it the sprinkling independent information. Why is that not sufficient? Well, there are counterexamples. We must have made a mistake. What could it possibly be? Well, here's what the mistake was. We said that a change of sprinkling, a change of the axis, is a change of basis. True. But not every change of basis is a change of sprinkling. I could also choose other changes of basis. I could, for example, choose the eigenbasis of the Laplacian. Or some other basis. What we were asking for when we distilled information out of the matrix G was only that the information is invariant under change of sprinkling. It is reaching too far to require that the information is invariant under all basis changes. That's too much. That's a loophole. And apparently, at least in those higher dimensional cases where counterexamples are known, that loophole is exploited. So too bad. Are we back to square one then? should we give up again? What about those counterexamples? Are they just too bad, we can't go beyond it, and spectral geometry should be forgotten? No, we are physicists. We're not afraid of any challenge, right? Let's just try and fix spectral geometry. So we try a fresh start for spectral geometry, where we try a little bit more modestly. See, in spectral geometry, the challenge is to take a spectrum and then, from the spectrum alone, recover the shape of some non-trivially shaped manifold. What a huge challenge, because this is a hugely nonlinear problem. If you're given the manifold, it's already very difficult to calculate its spectrum. But from the spectrum, how on earth are you going to recover the shape? Very nonlinear. So what we can do here is to try to solve a smaller problem, a much simpler problem, which hopefully teaches us about what went wrong with spectral geometry and how we might be able to fix it. OK, so if the biggest problem with spectral geometry is that it's highly nonlinear, let's linearize it. Let's try what I call infinitesimal spectral geometry. So the situation is this. Let's give up on trying to calculate the shape from the spectrum. Instead, let's assume shape is given and the spectrum is given, both. And now, imagine that the shape is changed a little bit, just a little bit. This will change the sound a little bit. So our metric goes into a perturbed metric. The spectrum goes into a perturbed spectrum. The benefit of all of this is that the change of spectrum and the change of metric ought to be linearly related. And basically, doing a Taylor expansion of that nonlinear map between the shape and the spectrum. And I'm looking at just the first linear order term in the Taylor expansion, at the derivative. So I'm only trying to recover small changes of shape from small changes of sound. Should be an easier problem. And if that doesn't work, well, then spectral geometry surely cannot work. But if it does work, then we can try to iterate the process. If we're given a target spectrum and we're supposed to find the shape that belongs to it, then we can try to iteratively change the spectrum in small, small steps, always calculating the small, small changes of shape until we arrive at the target spectrum and get the target shape. That's the plan. OK, so how do we describe that in practice? Well, let us take a metric. And just like when we describe the surface of a drum, when we hit on it, you know, we don't involve the metric tensor in any complicated way. Let's just put a scalar function on it that describes the elongation. So we change the metric. We perturb it by this conformal factor here, where f of x is some small amplitude scalar function. And then that function f, which perturbs our manifold, we can expand in the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator. Let's assume the eigenbasis is discrete. For that, we have to assume that the spacetime has a finite volume. It's a compact spacetime. I assume it's compact, finite volume, no boundary. Then there's a theorem that says that the spectrum is discrete and non-degenerate and has no accumulation points. OK, so in any case, the basis spans the Hilbert space because the Laplacian is a self-adjoint operator. So we can expand our function f, which describes this small change of shape. Let's say our vase grows a little bump, right? Grows a wrinkle, right? So we can encode that in the function f. And this function f, we can Taylor expand in the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator. And then the change of shape is now encoded in the coefficients of f in the eigenbasis. In other words, any change, any little change of shape of our vase can be described by a bunch of, by a discrete set of numbers, fn. Small coefficient numbers that describe how the manifold changes its shape a little bit. OK, so the fn coefficients describe the change of shape. Because they describe the change of metric. On the other hand, as this is going on, the spectrum changes. The eigenvalue lambda n, any eigenvalue lambda n goes into the eigenvalue lambda n plus a small change. And there's going to be some linear relationship between the small change of shape and the small change of spectrum. That's guaranteed. So it's a linear relationship, so there's got to be some matrix SNM. And in fact, we can calculate this matrix SNM straightforwardly using simply the methods of time-independent perturbation theory that we always use in quantum mechanics. Time-independent perturbation theory tells you how a spectrum changes as you change the Hamiltonian. But here, we don't change the Hamiltonian. We change the Laplacian a little bit. So as the metric goes from unperturbed to perturbed, the Laplacian goes from unperturbed to perturbed. So it's like having a starting Hamiltonian and adding some interaction terms to it. By the same calculation, namely this, they calculate the expectation value in the eigenbasis of the unperturbed Hamiltonian, in this case, unperturbed Laplacian, of the perturbation term in the Hamiltonian. And that gives you the change of the spectrum, as always. So we can calculate this change of this matrix S, which maps the small changes of shape into small changes of spectrum. Explicitly. Big question is it invertible? I mean, one way is trivial. Yes, as we change the shape, we change the spectrum. But can we do it the other way around too? Is S invertible? Well, let us look at a simpler situation. We've linearized it already. Now we take out another secret weapon. We regularize the theory. So while S is an infinite by infinite matrix, because the Hilbert space is in principle infinite dimensional, let us remember our dinosaur. We had only n points sprinkled on it. Let's do that again. We don't have to talk about sprinkling at this point. Let's just say we cut off the spectrum of the Laplacian because we have only a finite quality of vision, a finite quality of hearing. We cannot hear arbitrarily high frequencies when it comes to the vase. And we cannot see arbitrarily small wrinkles either. So let's say we cut off the spectrum of the Laplacian at the nth eigenvalue, capital N's eigenvalue, which means we can only hear the first n overtones. And the shape of the vase can only be perturbed using eigenfunctions up to the nth eigenfunction. The higher the eigenfunction, the smaller are the wavelengths of the eigenfunctions. It's just like in flat space. So we are cutting off the smallest wrinkles, and we are cutting off the highest overtones. Now, by using finite vision and finite hearing, our matrix S becomes finite dimensional and becomes an n by n matrix for the simple linear algebra reason that for every eigenvector, there's an eigenvalue. There are as many eigenvalues as there are eigenvectors, counting degeneracies. So it's a square matrix. S is a square matrix. If we count the dimensions, they are equal. Number of eigenvalues, number of eigenfunctions. Why does that matter? Well, it matters because the number of eigenvalues is the number of mu's. The number of, I mean, how many eigenvalues in the spectrum change? N of them, because they're n eigenvalues, right? So if you have n coefficients that describe change of shape, sound. One moment, let me just finish that argument. On the other hand, how many degrees of freedom do we have to describe change of shape? Well, as many as the eigenfunctions, because we are expanding the function f in terms of the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. Therefore, we have as many degrees of freedom that describe change of shape as we have degrees of freedom that describe the change of sound. That's why the matrix is square.
I'm wondering about the statement below there that this matrix should be generically invertible. I guess that should the statement should depend on the geometry that you run.
Yes, that is right. And yes, that is right. And I should put a qualification there.
Then, I guess you should always have an individual symmetry of moving.
That is true. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I have to put qualifications there. For example, if we use, if we look at this thing like a vase, but, you know, remember, we wanted to do it without a boundary. So it's just a two-dimensional manifold. Embedded or not, doesn't matter. So it's a two-dimensional compact Riemannian manifold. Then zero is always an eigenvalue. Because the constant function is always an eigenfunction of the Laplacian. Zero is always an eigenvalue, doesn't carry any information. It's there, but doesn't carry any information. On the other hand, the Laplacian is conformal, which means that the overall size also cannot be detected. Therefore, you have one degree of freedom of soundless and one degree of freedom of shapeless. Right? And then the remaining thing, it turns out, is generically actually invertible. So the point is, if this thing then is generically invertible, apart from qualifications like that, then we should be able to iterate. We should be able to deduce from small changes of sound, the corresponding small changes of shape, and then keep doing that, and therefore build up even big shapes from whatever spectrum is given. What is not trivial, though, is that if I go two different paths, always in infinitesimal steps, but if I go two different paths to the same target spectrum, that I will end up with the same shape. That's not trivial.
Now we do this and do the cutoff. And now we change the points slightly by some vertex displacement.
But which points are you talking about?
The sprinkling points.
But remember, we don't sprinkle here at all.
What is Fn? How is Fn?
Okay, let me remind you. So just a sec. Maybe I shouldn't have talked about the sprinkling of the dinosaur. That was just planting some misunderstandings there. Okay, so here's how it goes. Forget about sprinkling. Just no sprinkling happening in this business at all. Okay, just not happening. We have the metric, unperturbed, going into the perturbed metric using a scalar function f of x that lives on the vase or lives on the dinosaur. This scalar function f gets expanded. It's Taylor expanded in the eigenbasis, one slide earlier. It gets expanded in the eigenbasis of the Laplacian. So the fn are the coefficients of the expansion of this function f in the eigenbasis of the Laplacian.
So it's special to do 2D that you can encode everything?
Yes, very good. Exactly. This is 2D. That's right. That's right. But let me get to that when the time is right. So not to mix up various different things. So this is an argument that does not relate or refer to sprinklings at all. Okay, and remember that the cool thing about this is that those guys are independent of any choice of bases. Okay, because these are, this is describing the intrinsically, right? Because these are the eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator. And therefore, just intrinsically defined, it's a canonical way to, these coefficients fn are canonical. If you change coordinate system, doesn't change those fn. So these are pure shape degrees of freedom. OK, and then the sound degrees of freedom are just the perturbations of the spectrum. So we are mapping those coefficients fn into the coefficients that describe the change of spectrum, namely those mu n over there. Overall, we get a matrix from the change of shape coefficients to the change of sound coefficients. And that matrix, as we can calculate using perturbation theory, time-independent perturbation theory as usual. And then number of eigenfunctions, number of eigenvalues, square matrix, if we have finite vision, finite hearing. Yes, yes, yes. Getting to that. OK, but just a sec. So far, we did this in 2D. Let's see if it works. I mean, I can claim all sorts of things, but let's see if it works. So this is work with two summer students, Tetrav Hamre and David Aysen. And this is not really a dinosaur. It's a very, very simplified version. It's like the egg of a dinosaur. OK. So here, the challenge was this. We took a random shape, we generated a random shape, and had the machine calculate the spectrum of it, the spectrum of the discretized Laplacian on that. And then the machine was supposed to forget the shape and just from the spectrum recover what that shape was. To that end, the machine generated a random shape, calculated its spectrum, and compared it with the target spectrum. It was, of course, generally very different. And then it did the first step. It calculated, if I want to change the current spectrum a little bit in the direction of the target spectrum, then how do I have to change the shape? Then it did that, changed the shape a little bit. And then it restarted the whole thing and said, OK, now I'm here. The target spectrum is this. My current spectrum is that. How do I have to change the shape in order to get a little bit closer to the target spectrum? And iterated that. And eventually found a shape that had the target spectrum. And this is one of the runs. It takes half an hour to generate one of those things. And it takes only half a second to. The video is very, very quick. If you blink, you don't see it. This is the starting shape, just a sec. Hey. Not that fast. That's not how fast it ought to be. What is this? Ah, oh, damn it. OK, just a sec. We can go out of this, and I just started from the source file. Oh, what is this? Oh. What do I do here? Next? Yeah, all right. Default? Damn it. They're tricking me here. OK, so. OK, so you see, the big shape is the random starting shape. And the ending shape is the target shape. And it actually is the shape that was originally the one that was generated. Think of it like a crystal. That's what it is. And we held two points in the back there. We held fixed. All right. But I have much better movies coming up from my student, Mikhail Panin, who's sitting here in the front row. And it will be much better. Right. I don't know why PowerPoint doesn't want to do it. So, but now coming to your questions, it seems to work. We can get the shape from the sound, at least in two dimensions, for two-dimensional manifolds. But we know that there are counterexamples, at least in higher dimensions. So what gives? And here it is. Yes, we only did conformal changes to the metric. We get away with that for two-dimensional manifolds because they basically have only one degree of freedom there. But in general, for higher dimensions, that's just not true. Generally, we will have to perturb the metric using something that is of scalar origin, something that is of vectorial origin, and something that is truly tensorial. It's a decomposition that is very much used in cosmology all the time. There are tensor fluctuations, vector, and scalar. And it's a decomposition just like when you take an electromagnetic field and you decompose into curl and into the gradient. The gradient would be called a scalar component of the vector field because it originates from a scalar function. So similarly here, this origin, it's tensorial, all right, symmetric covariant two tensor, but it derives from a scalar and here from a vector, and what remains is truly tensorial. We have to look at all those perturbations. So what we were doing is we were not describing all possible perturbations of the manifold, and therefore we were missing out on a lot of shape degrees of freedom. We showed that we should be able to hear this, the conformal degrees of freedom from just the scalar Laplacian spectrum, but what about the others? Now we see why spectral geometry cannot possibly work in higher dimensions, at least not the way it's usually done. What we'll have to do is to make sure that the number of shape degrees of freedom, which just went up dramatically, right, because we have now all these extra changes of shape, we have to make sure that the number of shape degrees of freedom matches again the number of sound degrees of freedom. How do we do that? Well, we consider the change of spectra of Laplace operators not only on scalar functions, but we need also the Laplace operator on vector functions and the Laplace operator on certain tensor functions, namely symmetric covariant two tensors. Such Laplace operators are known. For scalars and vectors, there are canonical ones. For the symmetric covariant two tensors, there are different choices. But what matters is that they are self-adjoint and have an eigenbasis that spans the Hilbert space. If we do that, the number of shape and sound dimensions matches again, and we have a chance. I can't prove that it'll work, but it's certainly necessary. We certainly understand here why spectral geometry cannot possibly work with the Laplacian on scalars alone, but why this might just fix it. So in other words, one may be able to hear small shape changes, but we have to listen to the spectra of all types of waves. And when I say all types of waves, I mean, of course, you know, the spectrum of the Laplacian on scalars, the spectrum of Laplacian on vectors and on tensors. This is really the wave equations. We are listening to different kinds of sound. And that is the fact that different kinds of waves carry different kinds of information is well known in seismology, for example. If an earthquake happens, then seismologists will listen or record not only pressure waves, of which the dispersion relation and everything is known, but they will also measure shear waves. You know, a rock against rock can not only do this, rock against rock can also make that, right? That's very different. It propagates with a different speed. It reflects differently. For example, shear waves never make it into the liquid interior of the Earth because liquids don't have a restoring force for shear forces. So shear waves reflect off the solid liquid boundary of the Earth. This is how you can measure how deep down the transition is between solid and liquid. And so seismologists make use of the fact that different kinds of waves in the same medium still carry different kinds of information, and they collect it all. And here we just found the same thing, namely that if we want to collect all possible information about the manifold, we better listen not only to what it does in the scalar spectrum, but also for vectors and covariant symmetric two tensors. Yes, that's right. You cannot simply take, it's no longer as easy as it is for the scalars here. That's right. So the shape degrees of freedom, we have to check that we cannot undo whatever we do here with a Lie derivative, because that would be just infinitesimal diffeomorphism. That's right. Yes, it does, because it only reduces the number of shape degrees of freedom. It doesn't reduce the number of sound degrees of freedom. If it were the other way around, we would be in trouble.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
And then you see that the number of eigenvalues.
Yeah, so what we get is we get more spectral degrees of freedom than shape degrees of freedom, which means that the matrix has a very good chance of being invertible, whereas if it were the other way around, it would have no chance. So it's basically redundantly encoding it. Self-adjoint operators.
Self-adjoint operators. Yeah. It doesn't tell you much.
Yeah. Right. Right, but basically what I'm saying is that if you have a map from Rn into Rm, and m is smaller than n, there's no way you can invert that. But if m is larger than n, sure.
But then so far you told us that there should be, that the sound degrees of freedom should be different more than invariant. So I would be confused if you get even more information.
Well, they are, yeah, they are certainly a different morphism invariant because because the eigenvalues of those Laplacians, of course, are diffeomorphism invariant.
Yeah, so that's why I think you should rather get one-to-one.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, no, I think what it means is that, in fact, you, this map from the space of shapes into the space of spectra will only map into an n-dimensional submanifold of the space of spectra. Mm-hmm. But in practice, we don't have to determine which it is. We can just work with the pseudo inverse to do that. In fact, well, and I will get to that very soon because my PhD student, Mikhail Panin, who's sitting next to you, worked on a very much related problem. Okay, so here is the appeal to look at all types of waves rather than just the scalar ones. So the message overall of my talk was that spectral geometry might just be helpful, but we have to look beyond just the Laplacian on scalars. Then we have a chance. And in two dimensions, it looks really good because it seems to just work out very nicely. Also, we seem to understand now why it could not possibly work for just the scalars. So we see a reason for why there were those counterexamples. And so ultimately, we could perhaps pull off this trick where we can describe the curvature of space-time, even though I haven't really addressed the Lorentzian signature here. Let's just talk about space. But we could express the curvature in terms of two-point correlators, which originate in entanglement. And then from that, we can distill spectral information. And the spectra are nice because they are invariants of the manifold. If this is what we have to quantize, that should be relatively easier than having to work with something like a metric where we would have to separate the diffeomorphism degrees of freedom from what is actually shape degrees of freedom. Here we would be able to actually do this distillation explicitly. So key challenges are to do it, to show that we can actually do it. It's very difficult to prove these things analytically, but we can, just like we did it in two dimensions, we should be able to do it in three and four, actually numerically just try it out and do it. And then we need to go from the Euclidean signature to Lorentzian signature, where there are challenges. I have some results on that published, but it would take too far. I don't have the time to explain that, really. One of the nice things, though, about 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time is that, as Hawking and others showed, such space-times really only have a causal structure plus a conformal degree of freedom. And we may be able to do that with the propagators, because the propagators will tell us what is inside the light cone and what is outside the light cone. And then there's only a scalar degree of freedom, a conformal degree of freedom left. But it hasn't been carried out so far, just an idea. And of course, this is very much related to the work that Raphael Sorkin and his students are doing. And I'm hoping to have some very fruitful interactions there. This is where the flowers went. And finally, as I promised, there is this work of my student Mikhail Panin, who tackled the impossible, namely in two dimensions. For flat spectral geometry asks not only can we detect curvature from the spectrum, but spectral geometry also asks if you have a flat domain like this one. So it's just, think of it as a metal plate, a thin metal plate. You bang on it with a spoon. Can you, from the sound of it, determine what the shape of the plate was? This is the question, can you hear the shape of a drum? This has nothing to do with curvature. This is about detecting boundaries, right? But again, it's spectral geometry, detecting somehow shape, just not curvature, in this case boundary shape, from sound. There are counterexamples even in two dimensions. Even in two dimensions, there are you can write down domains that definitely are not isometric, but sound the same, same spectrum as a drum. So what Mikhail did is, well, what if I give myself a little bit more degrees of freedom of sound than shape? And that makes all the difference. And we can't prove that it always works, but he found a lot of examples where it does work. And here's one of those examples. I can show you some others. So the same principle as before. This is a target shape randomly generated, and the spectrum is calculated. Then the algorithm that Mikhail wrote is given just a spectrum. And then it's supposed to recover that shape. Now, there are a certain number of shape degrees of freedom in there. And the spectrum, of course, runs to infinitely many eigenvalues. And the choice was made to utilize more spectral degrees of freedom, more eigenvalues, than shape degrees of freedom. And that made it work. So this is a shape that was randomly generated. And then the algorithm calculated step by step, how should I change the shape so that the spectrum gets a little closer to the spectrum of the mystery spectrum that the algorithm was to find, I mean, for which the algorithm was supposed to find the shape. And then it changed the shape a little bit. And then it calculated again, how do I have to change the shape now to get a little bit closer to the target spectrum, and so on. And so in the movie that comes up now, you will see how that shape on the left gets changed by the algorithm so that the spectrum becomes closer and closer to the spectrum of this. And you will see how the shape gets closer as well. So it actually finds the shape. But again, coming back to Hillary's question, can't tell left from right. So sometimes in those things, you get the target shape, but mirrored. So let's see. There you go. OK, so that's the same shape as that. We have to click again. Now we mirrored it. And now we rotate it. And now we see it's the same. Okay. Then there's another one. Okay. Huh? Yeah, there are failures too if you want to see those. Okay, so that, and then rotate it. That's the same thing. Yeah. So the nice thing is that we see here that you don't have to give up on spectral geometry. There are ways to make it work. And I hope that some of you might find it useful someday in quantum gravity calculations. Thank you.